Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
This episode is brought to you by eBay. We all have that piece. The one that's so you, you've basically become known for it. And if you don't yet, fashionistas, you'll find it on eBay. That Miu Miu red leather bomber, the Cousteau Barcelona cowboy top, or that Patagonia fleece in the 2017 colorway. All these finds are all on eBay, along with millions of more main character pieces backed by authenticity guarantee. eBay is the place for pre-loved and vintage fashion. eBay, things people love.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty Fruity Pebbles. Early morning meeting, blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo! Run errands? Blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo! Fruity Pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today. Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today is going to be a solo episode, despite how badly I want Austin on this episode for so many reasons, not only to talk about the case, but to talk about so much of the stuff that's been going on with Mama Mystery behind the scenes. We just got back from CrimeCon in Nashville, and it was absolutely amazing. We got to meet so many of our listeners. We got to meet new listeners. So if you're listening for the first time because you met us at CrimeCon, hey, great to see you again, or hear you again, or hear me again, whatever. Okay, so that was awesome. The next CrimeCon is going to be in September of next year in Denver. So if you've ever thought about going, just pull the trigger and do it. You are not going to regret it. It is so amazing to walk among so many people who share the same interests, and then to bump into people that you see on TV or on your favorite YouTube channels or on your favorite like court TV or law and crime networks. I mean, it is crazy how we all just kind of walk among each other. Multiple times I ran into Josh Mankiewicz, and he is just the nicest guy. He's one of the correspondents on Dateline. I'm sure a lot of you know that. But yeah, the Boddins, I met with Linda Kenny Bodden again, and I'm bummed I didn't get to see Dr. Bodden this time around, but maybe I'll see them in Denver again. But Yeah, it is just an absolutely incredible time. So if you have ever thought about it or considered it, go to crimecon.com and look at the details, look at past events to kind of get an idea of what you can expect. So for those of you who have listened since the beginning and those of you who just started listening recently, I just wanted to let you all know that after Memorial Day, I decided to start publishing episodes every 2 weeks instead of weekly. We've got a baby coming in just a few weeks, like just a few weeks. So this is crazy. I actually had to deliver a keynote speech at a Women of Excellence event in my hometown. And the day before, my blood pressure was spiking. And so I had to go to labor and delivery and get checked out. And they were like, you just need to rest. Like, we recommend rest. And I'm like, okay, I will rest after I give a speech in front of 1,000 people tomorrow. But honestly, what is rest? I just can't. Like, we have a baby coming. We have a little guy that's 2.5. We've got a 10 and 9-year-old who are busy in events. Like, what is rest? Okay. I don't know her. So, anyway, as it relates to Mama Mystery, I'm trying to find balance, and that's always been super hard for me. I typically try to keep every bucket in my life full at the same time, but the older that I get, the more I realize and have accepted that I am human and I'm only capable of so much. And let this be a message to you too, if you struggle with that also. I tend to set my expectations for myself way too high sometimes and need to be okay with just prioritizing certain things over others. So I hope you will all understand and still support us through this change. We have an amazing audience of supportive and caring listeners, so I don't doubt that you'll stick around, but I just do hope that you know how much I appreciate it when you guys are patient with the content that I create and the frequency with which I do it. So with that being said, today we are going to take a break from the Karen Reed trial to talk about the murder of Dan Markell. So while I was in Nashville, I met up with one of my dear true crime besties, Jenny Matthews. She hosts a country radio station here in Kansas City, Q104. I'm sure a lot of you here in the area have heard of it. But one of her friends that she was there at CrimeCon with is familiar with the Dan Markell case. And I just kept hearing about this case. I was vaguely familiar with it. But there have been some recent updates that were just kind of like bombshell updates. And so today I decided to do a little bit of a deep dive, and that is what we're going to be talking about. So Dan Markell was born on October 9th of 1972 in Toronto, Canada. And from an early age, he had a keen intellect and a passion for learning. He went to a prestigious high school in Toronto where he excelled in his studies and displayed a remarkable talent for critical thinking and debate. After high school, Dan went to Harvard where he graduated magna cum laude with a degree in philosophy. And while at Harvard, he developed a love for law. His academic excellence earned him a place at the University of Cambridge where he pursued a Master of Philosophy in criminology. This experience broadened his understanding of the criminal justice system and further fueled his passion for legal studies. So naturally, Dan chose to go to Harvard Law School, where he then earned his JD. And during this time at Harvard Law, he was involved in various extracurricular activities, including serving on the Harvard Law Review, and his contributions to legal scholarship began here, as he wrote extensively on topics related to criminal law and justice. After graduating from Harvard Law School, Dan clerked for Judge Michael Daley Hawkins of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and this position allowed him to gain valuable experience and insights into the appellate court system. Following his clerkship, Dan worked as a litigation associate at Kellogg, Huber, Hanson, Todd, Evans, and Feigl, holy cow, that's a lot of names, in Washington, D.C., where he handled complex legal cases and honed his skills as a litigator. In 2005, Dan joined the faculty at Florida State University College of Law, where he quickly established himself as a respected and influential professor. He specialized in criminal law and legal theory, areas where he made significant contributions through his teaching, writing, and public speaking. Dan's scholarly work was published in numerous prestigious law journals, and he also co-authored several books that are widely regarded as essential reading in the field of criminal law. Dan was also the founder of Prof's Blog, a blog that became a prominent platform for law students to discuss contemporary legal issues.
Through this blog, he engaged with a wide audience, sharing his insight and fostering debate on important legal topics. His ability to explain complex legal concepts in an easy-to-understand and engaging manner made him a beloved figure among students and colleagues alike. And then a couple of his friends introduced Dan to a girl that they thought would be perfect for him, a girl named Wendy Adelson. Wendy Jill Adelson was born in 1979 to a prominent and affluent family in South Florida. Her father, Dr. Harvey Adelson, was a successful dentist who owned a chain of dental clinics, and her mother, Donna Adelson, was actively involved in the family business and various other community activities. Wendy was the youngest of three children, with two older brothers, Charles, who goes by Charlie, and Robert. The Adelson family was well known in their community for their philanthropic efforts and their social connections. Wendy excelled academically from a young age, attending some of the most elite schools in South Florida. After graduating from high school, Wendy attended Brandeis, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, so I'm sorry if I'm butchering it. But during her time at this university, she demonstrated a strong interest in social justice and human rights, which would later define her professional career. After graduating from Brandeis, Wendy pursued a Juris Doctor degree at the University of Miami's School of Law. She continued her education by obtaining a Master of Arts in International Affairs from the University of Cambridge. Her educational background provided her with this solid foundation in both law and international relations, which equipped her with the skills and knowledge to advocate for marginalized communities. Wendy's professional career was driven by her passion for social justice and human rights. Ironic. She joined the faculty at Florida State University College of Law, where Dan was working as a professor. And while she was there, she directed the Human Rights and Immigration Law Project. In this role, Wendy focused on providing legal assistance to immigrants and refugees, often working on cases that involved complex human rights issues. And as I mentioned before, Wendy met Dan Markell, a fellow legal scholar, through mutual friends. Their shared academic interests and passion for the law quickly blossomed into a romantic relationship, and the couple married in February of 2006, and soon after started a family, welcoming two sons, one in 2009 and one in 2010. So on the surface, it appeared as though Wendy and Dan were living a quintessential American dream with these prestigious, successful careers and two beautiful boys to show for their love of one another. However, beneath the surface, their relationship was full of tension, and Wendy's desire to relocate to South Florida to be closer to her family became a major point of contention because Dan desperately wanted to stay in Tallahassee for his job. Dan was also known for his rigorous work ethic and commitment to work, whereas after having children, Wendy's priorities shifted towards her family, not just her two sons, but her brothers and her parents in South Florida. And as time went on, the couple really just started to grow apart. Both of them were hyper-focused on very different things, and they essentially became ships passing in the night. So by 2012, the pair decided to split. Their divorce was finalized in 2013, but it was primarily fueled by disagreements over custody arrangements for their two sons. Dan desperately wanted to remain actively involved in his children's lives while he stayed in Tallahassee, while Wendy sought to relocate to South Florida so that she could be closer to her family with her boys. So even though the divorce was finalized, the custody arrangement for the boys was not. And despite the court putting a restriction on Wendy's ability to relocate to South Florida, she tried to do it anyway, with heavy support specifically from her mom, Donna, and her brother, Charlie. On June 20th of 2013, the judge denied Wendy's motion to relocate with her kids. But Wendy disobeyed the order and left for South Florida in 2014, and this is about 450 miles away. So, of course, this deeply upset Dan because he believed that this would severely limit his ability to spend time with his sons and maintain a close relationship with them. And then came the morning of July 18th, 2014. On this day, Dan Markell was following his typical routine. After going to the gym and dropping his boys off at daycare, he returned to his home in the Benton Hills neighborhood of Tallahassee, Florida. At approximately 11 a.m., Dan was in his car, a black Honda Accord, parked in his driveway. and he had just finished a phone call when he was ambushed by a man with a gun. The shooter approached Dan's vehicle and fired a single shot through the driver's side window, striking Dan in the head. The shooter then fled the scene, leaving Dan gravely injured in his car, and the loud gunshot caught the attention of a neighbor who immediately called 911. First responders arrived at the scene after about 20 minutes, which became a whole other issue in itself. But Dan was still alive when the paramedics arrived, but he was unconscious and in critical condition. He was transported to a nearby hospital where doctors worked tirelessly to save his life. And despite their efforts, Dan succumbed to his injuries later that day. Law enforcement officers quickly began their investigation. They cordoned off the crime scene and started collecting evidence. Witnesses in the neighborhood reported seeing a silver Toyota Prius speeding away from the area shortly after the gunshot was heard. They brought in Wendy Adelson for questioning and to deliver the news that her ex was shot and would not survive. And she was quick to offer her alibi that she was home that day and didn't leave the house until around noon. When she asked if she knew anyone who would want to do this, she replied that she knew that he rubbed people the wrong way and that there were people in her life who knew that he didn't treat her well. Then she offered that maybe it wasn't someone who killed him because they hated Danny, but because they knew he didn't treat her well and thought that it would help. So she offered up a name, Jeffrey Lacoste. Jeff was an associate professor at FSU at the time, and he was dating Wendy when Dan was killed. But she revealed to investigators that they had just gotten into a big fight just a few days before Dan was killed, and that she asked him for a week of space so that she could clear her head and think about if she really wanted to be with him anymore. So a few days after the shooting, the Tallahassee police brought Jeff Lacoste in for questioning. He admitted his feelings for Danny weren't positive, but he had an alibi for where he was during the shooting. He was already 500 miles away on his way to Tennessee, but he had told Wendy that he planned to leave around 11 a.m. on July 18th. Oddly enough, the exact time Dan was shot. So did Wendy know that this was his plan and help set up the shooting to make it look like it could have been Jeff? Jeff was ultimately ruled out as a suspect, but he did admit to police that just 5 days before Dan's murder, Wendy told him about how in the summer of 2013, her brother Charlie had, quote, investigated multiple ways to fix this problem of Danny Markell, end quote, which included hiring someone to kill him. So then investigators started combing through surveillance cameras throughout the neighborhood, and sure enough, this silver Prius that I mentioned earlier was spotted on multiple cameras speeding through the neighborhood after the shooting. So they figured that whoever was in the Prius was probably following Dan that day, and then they retraced Dan's steps to see if the Prius was ever close behind. So first, Dan went to the gym, and sure enough, the Prius followed closely behind him. When Dan left the gym, the Prius then followed him. So to get a closer look at the Prius, detectives gathered surveillance video from Tallahassee buses that were in the area at the time because they knew that these buses were equipped with cameras inside and out. Sure enough, a bus pulled up directly behind the Prius at a stoplight, and you could see two people in the car, but you couldn't quite make out the license plate. However, they did notice a toll pass device that allows you to zoom on through a toll. And 500 miles south, a silver Prius had passed a reader on I-75 the day before Dan was killed, headed in the direction of Dan's house. And then it passed through again the day he died, going in the opposite direction. The pass came back as registered to a rental car company, and the registered renter of this vehicle was a man named Luis Rivera. Also on the rental form was the name Brother and a cell phone number written beside it. So detectives investigated the cell phone records and found that the brother was Sigfredo Garcia. Sigfredo went by the name Tuto, and he had a significant connection to a street gang called the Latin Kings, primarily through close association with a high-ranking member named Luis Rivera. So Luis Rivera was later identified as the leader of the Miami chapter of the Latin Kings, and his influence within the gang and his criminal activities were well documented, including racketeering, for which he was arrested and sentenced to 12 years in prison just after Dan's murder. Nevertheless, Luis and Sigfredo had been close friends since they were kids. So even though Sigfredo wasn't an actual member of the Latin Kings, his close friend Luis was. So it took almost 2 years for the state to build a case as to who was responsible for Dan's murder. In 2016, Luis Rivera and Sigfredo Garcia were charged with the murder of Dan Markell, and both pleaded not guilty. But the question remained, why would these two thugs want to kill Dan Markell? What could their motive possibly be, and how were they connected to Dan? Today's episode is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. So I mentioned at the beginning of this episode that we just got back from CrimeCon in Nashville, and we had to take Ubers to and from almost everywhere we went. And some of our Uber drivers spoke almost exclusively in Spanish. And at the end of our ride, I would always say, "Espero que tienes un buen día," which means I hope you have a good day, or at least I'm almost positive that's what it means. But every time I would say it, I just felt really confident that I was able to say that. And Austin would look at me like, "What are you saying?" And then Austin, because y'all know Austin, would be like, "Yo tengo un pero in mis pantalones." And I'm like, okay, you need some help. So maybe you should hop on this trend that Jack and I, my son, are doing together, which is Rosetta Stone. I know it sounds totally nerdy and I will own that, but we have been teaching ourselves Spanish for a bit now. And even my son is learning. We're learning together because he's interested too. Not only is it this huge confidence booster to be able to communicate in two languages, but I also felt like speaking to someone in their native language was an extra little sprinkle of respect for them, and that just felt really good. And it's summer now, but last year there was a child in my son's class who spoke exclusively in Spanish. Like, even the teacher would have to translate on her phone to teach this girl the lessons. And so just the thought of my son learning so that he could talk to her and make her feel welcome in the classroom really warmed my heart. My son and I are able to learn directly from an app on our phone. We have lessons literally in the palm of our hand with Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning app. You can use it on your computer, your tablet, or your phone, and it truly immerses you in the language that you want to learn. Rosetta Stone has been trusted for 30 years now, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. You can choose from Spanish, French, Chinese, Korean, Italian. The list goes on. And the way it teaches you is truly immersive, thought-provoking, and allows you to pick up the language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences, because it's designed for long-term retention. There's even a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. So, unlike the grandma on Napoleon Dynamite, you'll be saying quesadilla the right way. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Mama Mystery listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/mama, M-A-M-A. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/mama today. And thanks again to Rosetta Stone for sponsoring today's episode. Let's get back to Dan Markell's story. Well, to answer that question, we have to back up a minute. As detectives investigated Luis and Sigfredo, they noticed that shortly after Dan's murder, the two were spending a lot of money on cars and motorcycles as if they'd suddenly come into a pile of cash. And this led them to believe that maybe they were hired to kill Dan. With Wendy's admission that things weren't great between her and Dan, detectives started looking into just how nasty their legal battle was. And they found multiple emails from Wendy's side of the family trying to come up with ways to make Dan go away so that she could bring the boys down to South Florida and raise them closer to their family. It was obvious in these emails that the Adelson family did not care for Dan, and they were desperate to make him go away. Wendy's mom, Donna, especially didn't care for Dan after he filed a motion in the courts to disallow Donna any unsupervised visits with her grandchildren after the kids admitted that Donna was speaking disparagingly about Dan in front of them. And the thing you have to understand about the Adelsons is that they are a powerful family in Coral Springs, Florida. The patriarch, Dr. Harvey Adelson, and his wife Donna ran the Adelson Institute for Aesthetics and Implant Dentistry. Together, they had three kids, Robert, who eventually moved away and distanced himself from the family, then Charlie, who followed in his dad's footsteps and became a periodontist, and then Wendy, who went to law school. I mean, these people are used to getting what they want. They set their mind to something and they achieve it. So Wendy and Charlie were especially close. Wendy even admitted to police on the day that Dan died that her brother once made a joke that when he bought her a TV as a divorce present, he said something along the lines of, "I was either going to get you a TV or a hitman, but it was cheaper to get you the TV." Now, let me just insert my own opinion here, not for nothing, but why would you admit that to the police the day Dan is killed? Like, is that not a joke that you should just probably keep to yourself in light of the situation? Like, it would be one thing if Dan was alive and you're telling people he made this joke, but he was in fact killed by what appeared to be an inside job. And she's just basically handing the cops over her brother on a silver platter by revealing that truth. And with her experience in law, I just have to think that that kind of speaks to me that maybe she truly didn't know what they were doing, because we'll get into that later, whether or not she was aware, but that just makes me question if she was aware. So like his sister, Charlie enjoyed a privileged upbringing, attending prestigious schools and benefiting from the family's wealth and social standing. Despite coming from this affluent family with a decent reputation, Charlie veered a little off track at times, associating himself with the wrong people. During the investigation, it was revealed that Charlie was involved with drug dealing and steroid use, as well as financial crimes, including tax evasion and insider trading. He was also caught using funds from his dental practice to pay for personal expenses and support his illegal activities. And it was also revealed that he often used his status to lure vulnerable women into his web. Vulnerable women like Katie Magbanua. Catherine Magbanua, often referred to as Katie, was born in the Philippines and later moved to the United States. Before her involvement in the Dan Markell case, little is really known about her early life, but she worked various jobs to support herself and her family. Katie was a single mother of two children she had with a man named Sigfredo Garcia. Before this case, she lived a relatively low-profile life. She had multiple jobs, including working at a dental office and then working as a bartender just to make ends meet. She and Sigfredo split after having their two kids, but they remained heavily involved in each other's lives because of their kids. But her life took a dramatic turn when she met Charlie Adelson, a wealthy and affluent dentist in South Florida. She started working for Charlie's dental practice, and the two really hit it off. Early on, Charlie wooed Katie. He was used to the luxury of coming from an affluent family and making a lot of money in his own right as a periodontist, whereas Katie came from more humble beginnings. He loved exotic cars and showing off his car collection, which included multiple Ferraris and Lamborghinis. He also owned jet skis and other high-end recreational vehicles. He just loved to be extravagant. So when Charlie started dating Katie, he really began spoiling her. In fact, in 2016, after Dan Markell's murder, she was given a Lexus by Charlie's dad, Dr. Harvey Adelson, and Charlie funded various cosmetic procedures for Katie during their relationship as well. So police questioned Katie and realized that she was in a relationship with Charlie Adelson, but that her whereabouts on the day that Dan was murdered remained unclear, other than that she was in South Florida. But once police realized that Katie was in a relationship with the ex-brother-in-law of the victim, slowly the pieces of the puzzle started coming together. So they asked Charlie for his alibi for the day of Dan's murder, and he too said he was in South Florida. Investigators knew they were onto something, and in the meantime, they'd have to keep a close eye on Katie and Charlie. So they examined the cell phone records of Katie and Charlie and found that not only were they making a lot of calls to each other around the time of Dan's death, but with other members of the Adelson family as well, notably the Adelson matriarch, Donna. Detectives eventually noticed a pattern where calls would bounce in order from Donna to Charlie to Katie to Sigfredo and then back in that same order. So they decided to start confronting the four of them in the order of those same phone calls to see if the information traveled in the same pattern, and it worked. It all started with a bump operation in April of 2016, nearly 2 years after the murder. A bump operation is described as this investigative tool where an agent or an officer makes contact with a person of interest during an investigation, with the goal being to either extract information or set up future meetings with that person. In this case, the undercover agent posed as a Latin King gang member and approached Donna right after she dropped her grandkids off at school. This officer approached her and handed her a newspaper article about Dan's murder with $5,000 written on the front of it. And he introduced himself saying, quote, "We know that your family has been taking care of Katie and her friend Tuto for quite some time after your problem up north. And I want to let you know that my brother, he's incarcerated. He helped your family with this problem you guys had up north. And we want to make sure he's going to be taken care of in the same way you've taken care of Katie," end quote. So he's essentially saying, you send this guy $5,000 for his help with Dan's hit and also confirm that you've been taking care of Katie in regards to this hit. And we knew at that point that Luis was already in prison. So that would be the brother that's incarcerated. So Donna acts like she has no idea what he's talking about. So he hands her the paper and says, well, you know, this will explain it, and walks off. And then Donna proceeds to go into the kids' school to call Charlie. In a call that was bugged by the FBI, they're investigating these phone calls. She says, quote, "If you have time tonight after work or some other time in the very near future, I'm going to need to speak with you." And Charlie responds, "Did someone write a letter to you or something?" And she says, I've got some paperwork delivered to me." And he says, "You're being sued?" And she says, "No, that's what I thought it was, but I'm going to need to talk to you." He asks some questions, but she's purposefully being pretty vague over the phone. So he says, "Does it involve us or other people?" And she says, "Probably the two of us. So you probably have a general idea of what I'm talking about." At this point, Charlie starts getting nervous and wants a little more detail about what he or what she was given and who exactly it was from. So he asks, "Was it anonymous?" And she says, "Oh no, it's not anonymous. It's not anonymous. I just don't want to discuss it over the phone." So they make plans to meet, and they purposefully schedule their meeting around a time when Donna's husband and Charlie's dad would not be there, which leads me to think that maybe he truly was unaware of their involvement in Dan's death. Just a few days after Donna was given that bump, a crucial audio recording was captured at a restaurant in Miami called Dolce Vita of a conversation between Charlie and Katie. The pair was seated at the restaurant, and their conversation was covertly recorded by the FBI. Charlie can be heard saying, "Even if they bug your phone, you're still not talking about any of this. So my point is, how do you get people to talk? You throw smoke grenades, and then you get all of the cockroaches to run out. Like, there's smoke in the house. There's smoke in the house," end quote. He goes on to say, "Listen, if that's what it was, it's very smart because that means my mom hasn't told my dad anything. My mom knows my dad is going to flip out when he finds out. But my mom hasn't told my dad anything. But normally, obviously, if that was a cop that came and spoke to my mom and that night he comes home from work, she would say, 'Guess who I ran into today?' Or 'Guess who paid me a little visit while I'm taking the grandkids to school?" Katie's response is unintelligible, and Charlie goes on to say, quote, "After she dropped them after she was walking home, she dropped them off and she was walking back by herself. So this person had to be, because the thing is, a lot of times my mom takes the car and drives them to school, the kids. So this person knew her routine and knows who she is," end quote. Then they talk about why they believe they weren't approached and that it's probably for the best because they, or at least Charlie, carries a gun on him. And he says, quote, "I mean, I'm going to start carrying one on my back, like, you know, the holster that fits on your back. If someone comes up to me, they better be ready to shoot because I'm going to shoot them. Someone comes up to me asking for money and my house. Guess what? When the police show up and there's a doctor, there's an oral surgeon standing there with a dead gang member in his driveway, they're not going to come down too hard on me and I'm not going to talk anyway," end quote. So throughout their conversation, they began using code words like surgical procedure as a euphemism for the murder plot, where they discussed the procedure as a way to talk about the logistics and the execution of the crime. The coded conversation, once decoded and contextualized by investigators, played a crucial role in linking Charlie Adelson and Catherine Magbanua to the murder conspiracy. The covert recording and the use of coded language were pivotal pieces of evidence. About a month after that recorded conversation at Dolce Vita, on May 24th of 2016, investigators established their connection between the Adelson family and Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera. Both Sigfredo and Luis were arrested and charged with murder, and the state informed them that they would be seeking the death penalty. And yet the Adelsons remained free at that point. On October 1st of 2016, Katie was arrested in Broward County and charged with first-degree murder, even though she wasn't with Luis and Sigfredo at the time. But as we've seen in Florida, with the Jennifer Mee Hiccup Girl case as an example, you don't have to be the one to pull the trigger to be charged with the crime that you helped orchestrate and commit. So a few days after Katie's arrest, Luis accepted a plea deal for second-degree murder in exchange for his testimony revealing the entire plot. He revealed that Sigfredo reached out to him regarding a job that needed to be done in Tallahassee. He admitted that he and Sigfredo drove from Miami to Tallahassee two separate times, a month apart, in the summer of 2014, and that at least on one of those trips, they drank a ton of little alcohol bottles and snorted a large amount of cocaine. He also testified that he didn't know he was going to take part in a murder until he was in the car on the way to Tallahassee. He said at the outset he thought it was just a job, like as a robbery, or that it wasn't until he was in the car that he learned Sigfredo had been hired to kill Dan Markell and that Katie was the one who asked him to do it. When he asked why, he said that Sigfredo said we were going to kill the man for some kids, for a lady because the lady wanted her kids back. He said Sigfredo was the one who pulled the trigger and that immediately after the killing, the first person he called was Katie. He also admitted that the entire job was paid for by Charlie and Donna and that when they returned to Miami, they were given $100,000 in stapled together dollar bills. Luis was given $35,000, Sigfredo was given $40,000, and then Katie was given the rest. So financial records showed that Katie had received significant payments from the Adelson family's dental practice, suggesting that she was acting as this intermediary in the murder-for-hire plot. And with the mountain of evidence against them, Luis Garcia, who pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for this compelling testimony, received a sentence of 19 years in prison. Sigfredo Garcia was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole. And Katie McBenoit was also found guilty after her first trial was a mistrial because the jury was deadlocked, but she was ultimately sentenced to life in prison without parole. But of course, the story doesn't end there because what about Wendy and Charlie and Donna? After the trials and convictions of the hitmen, Wendy callously chose to change her son's last name from Markell to Adelson. She claimed that it was in an effort to protect their identity, but Dan Markell's parents felt like this was just another blow to the Markells in an effort to eliminate them from the Adelsons' lives. I mean, after all, they could have changed the name to anything more ambiguous than Adelson. I mean, if anything, Adelson is probably more recognizable than Markell at this point. But Dan Markell's mom fought to protect grandparents' rights and created a bill that was officially signed into law in 2022. The bill is called the Markell Act, and it protects grandparents and children against alienation from each other in tragic situations, such as if one of the biological parents is deceased. Specifically, the bill says that grandparents can petition courts for visitation with their grandchildren where the living parent was found culpable by a criminal or civil court for the other parent's death. Then, in April of 2022, Charlie Adelson was finally arrested and charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder. His trial started in October of 2023, and during the trial, Wendy took the stand to defend her family. She consistently denied any involvement in Dan Markell's murder. She stated that neither she nor her family had anything to do with the crime, and denied that she herself had anything to do with it. Despite the revelation she gave to police the day that Dan was murdered, that her brother made that joke about hiring a hitman, but that a TV would be cheaper. The prosecution practically tore Wendy to shreds, highlighting the motives that she would have had to have the father of her children killed, which included her desire to relocate without restrictions from Dan, a $2.7 million in benefits for her children in monthly payments, and the contentious relationship that Dan had with her entire family, including his efforts to control the time that Donna could spend with the grandkids. But the bombshell really came when Katie Magbanawa, convicted of first-degree murder at that point, took the stand with an entirely new version of events. This time, instead of denying any involvement in the murder, Katie finally admitted exactly what her involvement was. Now, with nothing to lose, she said Charlie was the mastermind of this murder. Katie testified that Charlie asked her one day if she knew anyone who could harm someone. She said yes, Sigfredo. And from that point, Katie acted as the liaison between Sigfredo and Charlie because of the romantic ties she had to both of them. They didn't want to have to face each other, so they communicated through Katie. So she facilitated all the communication between Sigfredo and Charlie. And she continued to testify that after the murder, Charlie put stacks of stapled together cash in the trunk of her car, but that the money was damp, indicating that maybe it had been washed. And she also believed that Donna was the one to deliver it because, one, Charlie said he never kept cash at his house, and two, shortly before he gave the cash to Katie, he admitted that Donna was at his house. She also admitted that she never actually worked for the Adelson Institute and that all the checks given to her by the company, signed by Donna, were actually payment for her involvement with the murder. Charlie's defense to all of this was something out of a corny crime TV show. Charlie claimed that he was a victim in all of this as well, a victim of extortion. Charlie Adelson's primary defense was that he was a victim of an extortion scheme orchestrated by his ex-girlfriend, Catherine Magbanawa, and the hitmen, Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera. He testified that Katie informed him after the murder that individuals she knew were responsible for the crime and that they were demanding money to prevent harm to his family. So according to Charlie, he paid these individuals under duress, believing that they posed a credible threat to him and his family's safety. Throughout his testimony, Charlie adamantly denied any direct involvement in planning or executing the murder of Dan Markell. He stated that he did not hire anyone to kill Dan and had no foreknowledge of the murder plot. His defense sought to portray him as this unwitting participant who was manipulated into paying extortion money after the fact. The defense argued that the incriminating statements and coded language used in the recorded conversations between Charlie and Katie were misinterpreted. Charlie claimed that his comments were made under stress and fear and were attempts to understand and cope with the situation. He downplayed statements that suggested knowledge of the murder plot, and framed them as speculative discussions rather than admissions of guilt. The defense provided explanations for the financial transactions between Charlie and Katie, and they contended that these payments were not for arranging a murder, but were part of the extortion payments that he was coerced into making. The defense highlighted the pattern of these transactions to support the extortion narrative rather than a premeditated murder-for-hire arrangement. The defense also pointed out how often Katie's story changed from her first trial, then her second trial, and now her current testimony. During cross-examination, the prosecution, led by Assistant State Attorney Georgia Kappelman, meticulously dismantled Charlie's extortion claims by highlighting inconsistencies and logical flaws in his testimony. They pointed out the improbability of maintaining close, affectionate relationships with individuals who were allegedly extorting him, and used evidence from phone records, financial transactions, and the enhanced audio recording from that conversation at Dolce Vita to establish his direct involvement in the murder plot. So Charlie was ultimately found guilty of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Following Charlie Adelson's conviction, attention turned to other potential conspirators, particularly within the Adelson family. In April of 2024, Donna Adelson, the matriarch of the Adelson family, was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder, just as she was attempting to board a plane out of Miami to Vietnam. Her trial is expected to start this fall. Wendy Adelson, despite her controversial testimony and the initial suspicions surrounding her, has not been charged with any crime related to Dan's murder. She continues to live in South Florida, where she is raising her two sons, and since the trial, she has largely remained out of the public eye, focusing on her career and her children. However, the shadow of this case still looms large over her life. Now, I want to know what your thoughts are on this case. Do you really believe that Wendy didn't have any idea what her brother and mother were up to? Do you think the father, Dr. Harvey Adelson, was aware? Let me know your thoughts on our Instagram page at mama.mysterypodcast, or you can leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And until next time, Mama Mystery out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.